Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready? Yes, Kuwait is ready. Anyone else? Namibia? Ready? Norway? Is Norway ready? Pakistan? Yes, we're getting there. Very good. Listen, we had a very good morning session, and this session will be even better because we have such an excellent panel with us here today. They will focus on energy and water, and obviously the synergies between them. Very broad and different experiences we have from Cuba, we have from China, we have from the US, Norway, we have a professor from America, and we have a lady from the UN Secretariat, so we can't get any better. So this is looking very promising. We, I guess one of the reasons I was asked to moderate this panel is that, as some of you will know, Norway is a country where we actually get 95% of our electricity from hydropower. It's one of our, I think, one of the key reasons for our prosperity and for our successful development. And as we have heard earlier today, of course, water and energy has a lot in common. They are scarce and they are important resources for which demand will only increase with the growing population sizes in the future. And I think we're going to hear more about that from the different panelists. We know that we need to solve the issue of water and energy if we are to have a sustainable development. And we also know that this is extremely important if we want to handle climate change. Before I hand over to the panel, let me just remind you about the two consultations that we had in Oslo and Hague. In Oslo, we had the conference on energy and the importance of energy. And in Hague, it was a conference that focused on water. And that was part of the broad UN consultation. And as we all know, the remaining question, though, is how to answer, how we best do this synergy between water and energy, and how we can be able to make sure that it actually contributes to, as I already said, the sustainable development. I think I would, if it's all right with the panelists, we should try to concentrate for the first round, 4 to 5 minutes. And then, of course, we will have questions from you. And then the panelists will be able to answer and get back to it. And I would like then to ask Professor Mark A. Kane, who is the Professor of Earth and Climate Sciences at Columbia University. To start, he has a rich and varied background from different research on climate change and society, a lot of papers, and he is going to tell us a little bit about the linkages between water and energy. Professor, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I am a climate scientist, and I'm going to talk a bit about climate.
Microphone, please.
An expert on,
let's say, technical solutions that involve what sort of technologies might be brought to bear on this. But I want to just make a few remarks relevant to what the problem is as I see it. And I'll begin with a classic lyric from American blues song. You never miss your water till a well runs dry. Okay. The meaning of which is, well, you can interpret for yourself, but in essence, it's rare that people notice a crisis until it's upon them. And water is a building crisis that in some places grows gradually and in other places is something we can perceive in the future, and then there's a question of whether that's sufficient for us to manage to take action. If you look at climate change projections, it is pretty clear that temperature goes up. What happens to precipitation, what happens to water falling onto the ground is much harder to say for various reasons. And if you look back at the last century, you can see a systematic rise in temperature. And that's important for water use because it reflects on evaporation, and evaporation would increase. But you don't see much in the way of a systematic change in precipitation. Okay? So it's, to me, not to say that there's no particular problem, but as a reminder that with or without human intervention, the climate system is such that precipitation varies interannually, decadally, and so on. The world has, in many places, has always seen drought and flood, and people have either learned to adapt to them or they are no longer there. The present in that sense is no different. We have problems with water because of expanding population and expanding demand on water as a resource, even before we get to climate change. I'll come back to climate change in a moment. But one example of what I think is a rather bad planning in the view of, given that there is climate change, is this. I was a few years ago in a meeting, and they took us out to the Everglades in Florida, and there was a post in the water, and it said 2. And I said, well, what does that mean? And they said, that means it's 2 feet above sea level. Okay. This was in the midst of an explanation of a project to spend $34 billion U.S. dollars to reclaim the Everglades by increasing the flow of fresh water. And this is to be finished in 2034. And by my reckoning, that's just about enough time for sea level to rise that 2 feet and completely render useless all of these attempts to renew the Everglades. So it's foolish to contemplate the future without considering the things we know that will happen because of climate change. And it's perhaps foolish to ignore the warnings we have already. And I want to say, having said how uncertain many things are, let me say something that is relatively certain. Okay, we expect, for theoretical reasons and verified by models, that in essence, the wet places of the planet will get wetter and the dry places will get drier. The desert regions in the subtropics will expand. This includes particularly the Mediterranean region, North Africa, the Middle East. Okay, and one wrenching example is Syria. Over the last, really, 5 years or more, it's estimated that something like 1.5 million farmers have left rural areas and migrated to the cities, and this, of course, contributes to dissatisfaction and civil unrest. Syria had made itself agriculturally self-sufficient, and that's no longer true. The droughts in 2002 and 2007 and 8 were the worst on record, and there's good reason to believe that this one in particular, this change in particular, is related to climate change. That doesn't mean that there isn't a considerable component of natural variability contributing to this drought. And that, too, will continue. And we already know these things, and we have to have better strategies to react to them. I'll just give one more example and then be quiet. And that's East Africa. Which has been the scene of one of the worst humanitarian crises on the planet because of the combination of the essentially dissolution of the state in Somalia and the extreme drought in this part of the world. Now, climate change projections would say that this part of the world should be getting wetter, okay, which is not what happened in the last decade, okay, because climate change is not yet at a point where it can overwhelm the natural variability. And we believe that this is more likely a consequence of a mode of natural variability that is not so well captured by these climate models, and in particular because they don't make actual predictions from a fixed starting point. We believe it's more that kind of natural variability than it is just that the models are wrong. But it's a clear lesson that predicting that kind of natural variability and being able to deal with it is already exceptionally important, and certainly will give us practice for things that are more severe in the future.
Thank you very much, Professor Kane. It's now my pleasure to give the floor to Mr. Chao Dadi, who is the Director General Emeritus and Senior Researcher of the Energy Research Institute of the National Development and Reform Commission of China. Mr. Chao is an expert, as you will understand, on energy policy, energy system analysis, and he has also focused a lot on sustainable energy strategy, energy conservation, and climate change policy. He is also a founding member and the first executive director for the Beijing Energy Efficiency Center. So he has a broad and rich experience. And we're looking forward to listen to you.
Thank you, Chairman. We are talking about the goals and the frame for the future international cooperation in terms of the climate change. And of course, it's focused on energy and water issues. In my understanding, the goal is already be very clear, because the target is, the 2-degree target is already be agreed politically. And from the IPCC reports, we know that by 2050, the global emission of greenhouse gas should be cut into half or even more. And we have to peak the emission globally as early as possible. It's better than before the 2020. Or no later than 2025. Per capita emission will decrease into less than 3 tons carbon dioxide. Even if we have more population in future, we need to cut down into near the two tons of carbon dioxide. So it's very clear goals for the long term, but how to interpret that into the short term or the near term still is a challenge for all the countries, including the developed country and the developing country. Because up to now, the per capita energy consumption and emission in the developed country is still much higher than that number. The emission increase in the developing country is rapid, and some emerging country, including China, already the per capita emission is already near the lower level of the developed country. So that means if both sides cannot be changed, we cannot achieve that the real long-term goal. So what we can do is, of course, firstly, I think is we should put the priority most on the energy efficiency area. And the efficiency means two things. One is to use the energy more efficiently. But it doesn't mean that the efficiency can solve all the problem, because if the demand, service demand will be spread continuously, so efficiency cannot solve all the issues. So we need to think about what's reasonable and rational demand first. And if only look at the technology, we may forget what the demand is more rational or more reasonable. And if the developing country follows the current pattern of consumption and demand and emission demand, from the developed country. That's why I will have no solution for the future. So in my understanding is the near-term goal is that the developed country should to cut down the per capita emission dramatically and to make a pattern for the future convergence for all the countries. We cannot think about you know, one side some country keeps a high emission per capita and you can really help others to keep the low per capita emission for long. So I think that this is a very important point. The efficiency can help, but cannot really solve the rational demand issues. So the developing country cannot copy the current consumption and emission pattern from the developed country. So we need to explore a new approach of development in a more sustainable way as necessary. And on the other hand, the low carbon energy supply will be developed more rapidly than current pace. Although in some countries it seems very quick, but if you look at the total mix of the energy, the fossil fuel still play the dominant role. And along with the increase of the demands, most of them go to the fossil fuel as well. So this is the urgent demand that the low carbon energy should be developed quicker than before. So I think there's a lot of potential to do on the efficiency. Technology is there, and it's far from the maturity markets. Even in China, we do a lot of efforts on the energy efficiency. We found there's still a lot of room to improve. And we compare all the practice in different countries, found that the markets at this time is not really help the efficiency. To some extent, the markets have a lot of barriers to the efficiency improvement. So we have to work on the mechanism how to really improve the efficiency and to make the unreasonable or the some kinds of, we call it luxury demand, be not be spread. For the low carbon energy mix in the future, I think we have to think about different situation of different countries. In some countries, there are already coming into the so-called high-grade energy. There are many natural gas, hydro power, or nuclear. But in most of developing countries, especially the emerging economy, the coal still play a very important role. So in our cases, I think to develop the nuclear, develop the more gas, develop more hydro, still will be more, quicker and more significant impact on the energy mix compared with the contribution from the wind or solar. But anyway, we need to do a lot of things on that. If we really think the future energy mix can based on the renewables, there are still a lot of technology improvements should be completed. And because up to now, all the application of the model system, modern system of energy, still is based on the backup and the system support of the fossil fuel. So if you want the new renewable becomes a major, 90%, for example, or even some people said 100%, then you have to change all the system dramatically. So it's a long way to go. So I think that later on, if people are interested, I can give the number of how the China developed these kinds of efficiency and the renewables or the low carbon energies. But I would like to stop right now here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chow. And then we move on to Ms. Samantha Smith, who is the director of World Wildlife Fund's Global Climate Change and Energy Initiative. And through this initiative, she's been working towards a low-carbon, safe and sustainable future for all. But she also has an interesting background as former working in the new energy division of Statoil, which is one of which is the biggest Norwegian energy company, where she also worked on renewable energy and also on CO2 projects. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency. So we heard some great presentations this morning about the nightmare world towards which we're heading quickly because of climate change, about all of the difficulties of putting together an agenda that eliminates extreme poverty and at the same time fights climate change. And we heard rather less about all of the solutions are there. So that's actually what I would like to talk about. We're pretty sure that there will be 9 billion people on the planet by mid-century. And all of those people could live in a world where everyone has access to clean, safe, reliable, and affordable energy and water. In fact, on the energy side, we could do this by 2030. It wouldn't be that expensive, and it wouldn't increase global emissions by a serious amount. In that world, deaths from indoor and outdoor air pollution would drop dramatically, because a lot of those deaths right now are coming from the use of unsustainable biomass in the home, but also from the burning of coal and other fossil fuels. In that world, most, even all of our energy could come from sustainable, renewable energy. And the word sustainable is important because, as we heard this morning from the Minister of Environment in Brazil, an energy system that is based on fresh water is a vulnerable energy system in a world that is affected by climate change. In the developed world, we will no longer have the excessive use and waste of energy and water that we have today. We will have sustainable consumption of these resources as well as of food, which is, again, a major intersection of the food, energy, and water nexus. We'll have healthy natural systems that support people, the billions of people who depend on them directly, and everyone else who supports on them indirectly. We will no longer live with the threat of dangerous climate change as we do today, and we could also have eliminated extreme poverty, again, well before 2050. That is the world we want, and as we understand it, that is what this discussion is about. It's not just about the world that we don't want, it's about how we get to this world that we want. Now, again, we heard excellent science this morning about where we're headed if we don't change. But what we haven't heard as much of is about the science that shows that all of these things are achievable without major technological innovations. In fact, the technology for achieving these things is out there. It's not yet commercial, but it could be, also with the help of global goals. We've been asked to say a little bit about what we think the priorities should be to get to this kind of future. There are many different ways to set up global goals, and of course, WWF is by no means an expert in this. But clearly, people must be at the center of these goals. Clearly, they also must address this deep interconnection between people and the natural world. What we heard again and again this morning is that development only takes place now within these planetary boundaries, within these hard limits on how much CO2 we can put into the atmosphere, how much fresh water is available to people in certain places at certain times, and also how much energy we can use, how much energy we actually need. We've suggested three global goals. There, of course, could and should be others, but we think that they could be framed around sustainable energy, sustainable water, and sustainable food. It's important to stress two words, global and sustainable, because a goal, especially in the energy field, but also in the food field, that is only directed at developing countries is an inadequate goal. We must address overconsumption, wasteful consumption, and unsustainable production. We must address consumption in the rich world. These goals, in addition, must have elements of finance, of technology transfer, and of governance, again, critically important in all three dimensions. We think that these kinds of goals would get us closer to this world that we want, and away from the four-degree world that has been described so vividly for us, where people are experiencing major heat waves every other year, where 30% of the world's animal species face the threat of extinction, half of the world's plant species, where those who depend on rain-fed agriculture today are going to see up to a 30% drop in agricultural production, and all of the many other climate crises that we've heard about this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much indeed. And now it's the pleasure to give the floor to Ms. Gisela Alonso Dominguez, who is the president of the Cuban Agency of Environment, a position she has had since 1999. Ms. Alonso has also previously held several positions in the Academy of Sciences of Cuba and participated in different conferences of the United Nations. She is also a member of the Secretary General's high-level panel, and a very experienced lady, and we're very much looking forward to hear you.
Muchas gracias. Pedí, si es posible, el PowerPoint. No? Okay.
Thank you very much. So perhaps we could have these slides on the screen. I'd like to thank you for organizing today's panel discussion. And I will be speaking on behalf of the small island developing states, on behalf of a developing country. And I will address certain aspects that we did not address this morning. And I will also try to introduce for you the experience of my country. I'd like to begin with some fundamental matters. Sustainable development and its three pillars. So the socioeconomic, social, economic, and environmental pillars. And of course, the energy element therein is of major importance. It's important to realize that if you were to address the major fundamental challenge of poverty, well, you cannot just limit your efforts to food security. As was said this morning, there are other challenges to be addressed pertaining to health, science, and the creation of new infrastructure, new technologies. Here on the screen, you'll see a map of Cuba. Cuba is, in fact, an archipelago in the Caribbean Sea. Cuba consists of more than 4,000 small islands in addition to the main island. We also have a coastal area, 1,200 kilometers long. The main island, of course, is very narrow, 191 kilometers at its widest point and 31 kilometers at its narrowest point. Now, when I speak to the matter of water and the water challenges we face in Cuba, you'll understand why I'm mentioning these geographical features of Cuba. Since 1959, we have been striving to implement a model based on equality and social justice, and also geared towards protection of our natural resources and environment. Cuba's natural resources had been very highly exploited, its subsoil, forests, and water. And over the past few years, we have been seeking to redress this matter. We have a very clear policy on research and on data gathering, and this has enabled us to to meet the challenges of the new situation that we face. Now, I'll continue without the PowerPoint, in fact. As regards climate change, as I was saying, Cuba has spared no effort in the area of research and new technology. We've set up a very major technological infrastructure base. The reason we've done this is because Cuba is situated in a very vulnerable climate zone where we have extreme weather events, and we have created models. We've created models with the Caribbean Climate Change Center, and our aim has been to model the kinds of changes that we may see across the region, and also to design adaptation measures. For Cuba, the main challenges we face are tied with the increase in sea levels and on the main island, we have a lot of subterranean water that is linked in with this ocean, and it's very vulnerable to salination. So this, of course, has impacts on agriculture, industry, and also on drinking water for the local inhabitants. Another challenge we face pertains to rising temperatures. Temperatures, of course, are rising and have been rising since the past century, and this has impacts on agriculture and on health. We have also the phenomenon of hurricanes, droughts, and rapidly changing levels of precipitation. And when it comes to energy, we are very much dependent on fossil fuels. 4 years ago, we launched an energy revolution, and our aim was to build efficiency and also to create a more efficient infrastructure.
94% of our energy is generated by fossil fuel, and only 5% through renewable energy. We're making considerable efforts on solar energy. We don't have major rivers with a considerable potential for hydro energy, but we are trying to work in different areas. So we've evaluated the impact of climate change and the impact it would have on water resources and with regard to forest cover. The forest cover has been reducing due to fires. Also, we've been suffering from loss of biodiversity, and this has affected some of the most important ecosystems we have. We've had loss in harvest. We've had considerable losses in agricultural production, and of course, the quality of water, as I said, due to salination. We've also had considerable coastal erosion. We have made a simulation, and that by 2100 we will lose more than 6% of the coastal areas of Cuba. We are examining additional investments in this area, especially in developing tourism. Our beach tourism is very important, and we are incorporating this simulation in the long run, in our long run plans. Furthermore, we have sought to evaluate the impact on fundamental ecosystems such as wetlands, coral reefs, beaches, and we have had to start to rehabilitating beaches in some areas of the country. We have lost considerable amount of beach areas because of the increase in the sea level. Now, without taking into account forecasts and without taking into account the latest data on glacier melting, people speak of having 5 to 7 meter increase in the sea level by 2010. Furthermore, we've put a great deal of priority, and I think this is very important for small island states, in studying various risks. We've begun studying the possibility of natural disasters, but this has to do with the major rainfall increase in the sea level. And when we've completed these studies, what we have understood is that this is essential for adaptation. In fact, what we have done throughout the country and all the provinces and all the towns, and this is making it possible for us to have a territorial management that is completely different from what it was in the past. With regard to water, we had a policy of 40 years ago of having catchment areas and having dams, and this has made it possible for us to cope with much of the drought we've experienced over the years. We have 75% of waters that we are managed in river basins, 632 river basins, and our people, in fact, have 91% of the water they use has been processed, and they have a developed sewage system. We have a plan to cope with climate change that includes some mitigation measures that are not very significant, because we are not major, we're not a major source of emissions of CO2, but we do have a series of measures for of adaptation. It's very considerable and broken down by sectors and regions. Furthermore, we can say that we have sought to learn lessons, and we've done that, and we've tried to incorporate them, and we've developed a number of measures, and I can conclude on by telling you about these measures based on these lessons learned. As I said, the main threat for us, as I said, is the increase, the rise in the sea levels, and we're working in the main vulnerabilities of the coastal areas. We are obtaining new scientific results, including crops that are more resistant. We have completely changed the method for territorial planning and management. We are conducting strategic environmental studies, and we have acquired new technologies based on our capacities, on our financial resources, and we have also considerably improved early warning systems, which are very important for countries such as us that face considerable vulnerability. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Gisela, for sharing the Cuban experience with us. It's now a pleasure to give the floor to Amina Mohammed, who, as all of you will know, is the Special Advisor of the Secretary General on post-2015 development planning. And you bring to this position a wealth of previous experience. It says in my manuscript the past 30 years. That must be a mistake. You didn't start when you were 10, did you? Or how is this? Anyway, you are indeed one of the pioneers in this sector, Amina. And you have also a background from both public and private sectors, as well as civil society. And you have also a background from Columbia University here in New York. Amina, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. You're judging a book by its cover, and I'm glad you think I'm 42. this is really an incredible opportunity, and I'd like to appreciate the PGA for bringing up this particular thematic debate in the post-2015. And as I was coming through the doors, I thought I must remember not to talk about sexual reproductive health rights. It's water and energy now. It's a huge agenda we're speaking about, and today we start off with, in the morning, sustainable development, the climate change challenge, and this afternoon, focusing on water and the energy nexus, and certainly the science was spoken about this morning, and as my colleague Samantha talked about, the nightmares, and I often say, well, we hear about the nightmare, we walk out the door, and then we wake up and do nothing about it, and I'm wondering what it is in this debate that will give us the hook to really understand that we're not waking up from that nightmare. It will continue unless we do something really urgent about it. And then to hear the expertise and the different lenses just before me. I'd like really to speak about how we will sort of help very quickly introduce into the debate what is going to come out of the next 18 months to 2 years, a framework for post-2015 and the goals that will come. And knowing the challenge, at least for the last 9 months of the high-level panel, the outreach has, for me, the ask has been over 154 goals. So we know that when we're coming to goals, we've got a certain menu there that is not going to be swallowed whole. We will have to find a way to make the best of one that worked as well as the MDGs. The poverty agenda is going to be critical to this. Issues and challenges around the responsibility. We've heard about how we go forward in terms of the responsibilities to our footprint. It will be a question of livelihoods and lifestyles and how we make the choices for that. The cost of disaster, urgency, we wait till it happens, but can we be ahead of that? At the end of the day, it will be about people, and it will be about those affected and those that are responsible and have to take on responsibilities. And currently, if we speak about just the water and the energy nexus, scarce, critical for survival, and it's a distant reality for millions and millions of people. We are lucky that, in a sense, we have some base to start from. The MDGs have been successful, and we often say whether we talk about the glass being half full or half empty, it is full some. And so there will be a transition as we look at what we've managed to achieve and what we still have to achieve of the existing challenges. But it will be transformative because we'll be looking to a sustainable development agenda, one that goes beyond just looking at it through the lens of the social agenda, but trying to see that no one gets left behind in the economic agenda and that we are looking at the environment in a very real way. Integrating the three is certainly a wider agenda from what we've had. It's also a much different way of looking at things. We will have to come together out of the silos into an integrated approach of addressing many of these issues, no matter what the science is, the urgency, the investments. That, I think, is going to be one of the major challenges that we have. How do we actually become fit for purpose? Government, civil society, the science community, all trying to make this work in an agenda that should continue at a greater pace from where we leave off with the MDGs. And so it brings me really to perhaps a few points to help generate some more discussion. Access for people and economies, because, one has a bearing on the other, but I hope that we put people at the center of this, recognizing that we still have the planet that we need to survive. So sustainability is going to be an important part of the equation every time we run it through a policy framework. The impact of the opportunities that we have for the synergies and partnerships, I think, on development, the development of the water energy nexus that everyone speaks about, from clean energy, our hydro and otherwise, but also our cities, the biodiversity agenda, and how efficient we can become. Already we haven't been as efficient, but efficiency also costs. It also requires quite a lot of attention to the different partnerships that have to be addressed. The integrated management of all of this will take its place in it, and how we address that. I think we've heard many a proposal for it in other sectors. Is there something we can learn from? Do we not repeat some of the same mistakes that we have in the past? The new partners for this agenda that we speak about, the resources that we're going to require to actually frame this, we talk about partnerships, we talk about synergies. The synergies will come from the policy, they will come from all the best practice and the science behind it. The partnerships will involve people that need to invest, and they'll need to invest off the back of opportunities. None of this is going to come with charity. We've addressed a development agenda that looked at the poverty and the misery, and we looked at ODA for that. It's going to go beyond ODA for sustainable development. How do we bring in business in a way that protects people, but at the same time gets the investments needed at scale? And so I believe that the challenge we have, and I hope this debate will help to do that, is that we don't talk about negotiating and trade-offs, that we actually talk about an integrated and efficient agenda that gets something for everyone, that we don't leave everyone behind, and that we put a big underscore under transition, because this won't happen overnight. This is a huge agenda, and the thought that we will move from one agenda to another will cost, will take the human resource capacity, institutional capacity at the different levels. Our countries that are involved coming in or out of conflict are a big player here. They have over 1.5 billion people living below the poverty line. How will they be included, and how will we be able to address this agenda to make sure they're not left behind? Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Amina, for giving us a few challenges and indicating also where the solutions could be. I now open the floor for comments and questions. In this regard, you are encouraged to limit your interventions to 3 minutes, so that all the requests from the floor can be responded to. You're also encouraged to provide your full-length statements to the Office of the President or General Assembly for posting on the website of the President. And I have now the pleasure of giving the floor to the representative of Slovenia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the honor to address the distinguished panel on behalf of the Green Group, informal group of Cape Verde, Costa Rica, Iceland, Singapore, Slovenia, and the United Arab Emirates, a partner of today's very important thematic debate. In 2009, the foreign ministers of our countries, representing different regions of the world, decided to act together in advocating ambitious environmental foreign policy action. Water and energy are strategic assets which require integrated policy frameworks, political engagement, and fast economic initiatives. Water and energy management are highly connected and should be influenced by adaptation to climate change. Climate considerations have to be included into integrated management strategies for urban areas as well as for rural development. In many countries, climate challenges, lack of drinking water, and access to energy resources are hampering eradication of poverty and have extremely negative impacts on empowerment of women. Members of Green Group believe that without addressing water and energy challenges, we will not be able to ensure decent living conditions to the world population, nor will be able to secure them for future generations. I would like to thank the panelists for their thoughts and in-depth analysis, and I would like to echo the request of Germany made in the morning session to distribute their presentations. Given the importance attached to both water and energy issues in the context of sustainable development in Rio, I would like also to hear your assessment how can an overarching post-2015 development agenda best ensure that the benefits of clean water and energy are secured for future generations, and how specifically should the Open Working Group on Sustainable Development Goals address this issue? Thank you.
I thank the representative of Slovenia for excellent questions and also for reminding us about the importance of empowerment of women. I now give the floor to the representative of Sri Lanka.
Thank you, moderator. My delegation associates itself with the remarks made by the distinguished permanent representative of Fiji this morning on behalf of the group of Shenzhen and China. I would like to give some of the comments in broad sense as well as in perspective of my own country. The world is continuing to be buffeted by the increasingly ferocious challenges of global warming and climate change. Despite the obvious threat posed to humanity, we continue to consume more and more natural resources in vast quantities, especially water and energy. This is an obvious phenomenon in the developed world. With the societal modernization and industrialization, the demand for water will continue to surge unless when we take concrete steps to address these challenges. Changes to the climate are not limited to an increase in the global temperature, which is now a reality. In parallel, rising sea levels, increased salinity, change in rainfall patterns, unpredictable weather, and consequent natural disasters will become common with devastating implications for humanity. Millions of people will suffer and economies of many countries will be damaged. Climate change could result in development reversals, increased displacement, aggravated tensions and conflicts over finite resources, and destabilization of fragile nations, especially in the most vulnerable, such as island states and the poorest regions. Environment refugees will pose a new threat to international stability. Due to climate change and changed weather patterns, the amount of potable water and water for agriculture and industry is likely to decrease rapidly. Increasing salination, desertification, depletion of groundwater levels, and chemical contamination are the other looming threats. These must be addressed collectively, not only by looking at them in the environmental context, but also from societal, economic, and security aspects as we are now heading for the post-2015 Sustainable Development Agenda. Mr. Chair, there are merits and demerits of considering water as a commodity and not as a natural resource. Once we went through a phase when large companies attempted to monopolize water in order to profit from it. As we heard during the recent discussions on the World Water Day, water must not become the reason for generating tensions among countries and communities, but it could. The ability could, to pay any price for water by an affluent minority should not be allowed to cause suffering for those who have no capability to pay. It's same as for energy, especially sustainable energy. In Sri Lanka, we have explored almost all possible avenues to mainstream sustainable energy options, such as hydropower. However, recent rapid climatic changes have resulted in irregular rain patterns and extreme droughts, making it necessary to employ more carbon-emitting options. The cost of deploying modern technologies to make our energy generation and consumption more sustainable, the production of green energy is high. Even though there are investment opportunities, new technologies are costly and are often associated with high patent fees. The progress on climate discussions to set goals for stabilizing global temperatures is painfully slow. The crying need is for far-reaching and ambitious workable solutions, such as a supportive policy environment, innovative but real and tangible financing. Technical capacity building are required by countries which need to adapt in the impacts of climate change and also undertake mitigation measures. Even though the world's biggest polluters are aware of the threat of this enormous challenge in front of humanity, what has been done so far in response is less than satisfactory. Given the crucial role of water and energy in poverty eradication, healthy and dignified living and sustainable development, and its deep linkages to other priorities such as food, health and housing, and also townships, it is essential to include water security in the formulation of sustainable development goals. Therefore, all aspects of sustainable use of energy and water in housing, transport and agriculture must be explored. Adequate financial support must be arranged for the marginalized communities in particular in both developing and developed countries to enjoy these two priority resources to upgrade their life sustainability and to face future without any climate threats. I thank you.
I thank the representative of Sri Lanka. And I now give the floor to the representative of Japan. Japan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As previous speaker has already pointed out, especially in this morning, climate change poses threat to us, and we must take a holistic approach to solve them, as silo thinking cannot effectively meet these challenges. We, who belong to the current generation, need truly transformative change, change which includes realizing low carbon growth in order that we may bequeath this precious planet to future generations. The role which government can play in this regard is limited in terms of finance and technology. If we were to rely solely on measures taken by governments, we would not be able to meet the challenges of this age. We must gather our wisdom and proved incentives that will bring all stakeholders, including the private sector, on board and thereby mobilize their powers. Providing incentives and level playing field are necessary for a government to compel companies to develop such innovative technologies and to invest and develop in new business models. In this regard, we commend the government of UAE for introducing its mandatory water and energy efficiency standards for buildings and low-carbon energy program. Japan is proud of its wide range of technologies, from cutting-edge technologies to down-to-earth technologies, and has endeavored to share this technology with the world. For example, the government of Japan will hold the second East Asia Low Carbon Growth Partnership Dialogue in Tokyo this Saturday. At the dialogue, ministers and other participants will exchange their views on a number of topics related to low carbon growth, promoting technology transfer, and the effective use and potential of various approaches, including market mechanisms. Exhibition of various low carbon technologies, as well as site visits to a solar power plant and a wastewater treatment center, are also scheduled. I believe the purpose of today's debate cleaves very closely to the purpose of the dialogue in Tokyo. Therefore, we look forward to lively discussion at today's debate, leading ultimately to concrete suggestions for practical solutions. I also hope to report the result of today's debate as one of the inputs to the dialogue in Tokyo this weekend. The similar type of dialogue and cooperation are ongoing between Japan and African countries. The achievements so far will be duly shared within the national community on the occasion of TICAD 5, that is Tokyo International Conference on African Development, that will be held in Japan at the beginning of next month. Thank you.
I thank the representative of Japan, and I now give the floor to the representative of Kazakhstan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our delegation would like also to join other delegations in commending President of the General Assembly for convening this meeting to address the critical energy-water nexus in planning sustainable development, especially in the post 2015 phase. Global action mobilizes implementation at the regional and national level. Kazakhstan has launched a major endeavor of energy water sufficiency and set high and ambitious targets for its national development. By 2050, it aspires to be among the top 30 most developed countries globally based on a modernized and diversified economy. By 2030, the country aims to reduce the stress on key resources, water, land, to improve strained and aging infrastructure, especially of the energy system, reduce local water and air pollution, and to increase national security by reducing water dependence. The Minister of Environment Protection of Kazakhstan has initiated a national program called the Green Economy Strategy for Kazakhstan, which, when finalized, will be formally adopted by the government. Though started independently, it is one of the projects supporting the Secretary General's Sustainable Energy for All initiative. The country has already set concrete and achievable targets for the main resources, such as alternative electricity will constitute 50% in the energy supply by 2050, and energy use efficiency will increase by 10% annually until the year 2015. These targets represent a clear departure from the business-as-usual trajectory of the Kazakh economy. Kazakhstan will achieve this transition by taking action across six main areas: water, agriculture, waste, energy production, energy using sectors such as industry, buildings, transport, and air pollution, with concrete measures for each relevant target area. The government is increasing incentives and awareness for consumers to act through energy saving products for daily use, providing financing for companies to invest, and monitoring so that standards are followed. It will consider a dual approach of raising the tariff and providing capital support for these innovations. Water, like no other resource, exemplifies how Kazakhstan's economic ascent could be stopped by resource scarcity, even though water is now adequate. The country thus wants to benefit from adopting a new model of water usage, so as to enhance the country's economic and social development potential, its security and independence, and its biodiversity and fragile ecosystems. To achieve drinking water balance by 2020 and irrigation water balance by 2040 will require significant infrastructure investments, efficiency across all sectors, better governance and regulation. Kazakhstan will thus move away from a water constraint to a water-enabled economy. We stand ready to join the multilateral action to find new approaches for the water energy security nexus to encounter the challenges of the 21st century. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I I thank the representative of Kazakhstan, and I now give the floor to the representative of China.
Before I proceed, I would like to make a clarification that the following statement is prepared for and supposed to be delivered at the morning session. However, due to the time constraint, we have to postpone it to the afternoon session. And having said that, please allow me to switch to Chinese for this statement.
Mr. Moderator, China supports the statement made by Representative Fiji on behalf of G77 and China. Climate change is the common serious challenge faced by the international community. It has important bearing on the well-being and the development of the people of the world, and it requires the cooperation and a coordinated approach by all countries. All countries have the responsibility to, in accordance with the principle of and common but differentiated responsibilities and the responsibilities of equality, and to deal with this problem, to deal with the climate change, it is an important element in international strategy. Therefore, an adaptation to the climate change should be carried out in a sustainable manner. And at a Rio conference, leaders of the countries and signed a declaration on the world we want. In accordance with the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, they are committed to the development and to work in accordance with the UN and the Convention on Climate Change and try to make more efforts in the water and energy areas. Developed countries should, in these areas, provide more support to the developing countries and to help developing countries better manage their water resources and to optimize their energy mix. Water and energy are the premises for the development. Development of renewable energies is an important guarantee to develop energy and to achieve development. China has made enormous efforts in the renewable energy resources and in the hydropower and the solar power. We have also made some progress. Developed countries in these areas have an advanced technology and experience. They should provide the necessary support and finance to the developing countries. Developed countries should provide developing countries with better opportunities for develop environmentally sound technology. Especially, they should do away with the practice to set up trade barriers to the developing countries in these areas. This will not only help developing countries achieve their own development and adapt to the climate change, but also and make a contribution to achieving the goals set out by the United Nations in the sustainable and development area. Thank you.
I thank the representative of China, and I now give the floor to the representative of India.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, I have a prepared statement which my colleagues will hand over to the secretariat. Please allow me to say a few words without really reading from these. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you very much for convening this meeting, but I must say that not having been a member of the Trusteeship Council for one hell of a long time, I didn't realize how cramped this space has become. I think this is one of the foremost elements of reform that we need, at least to make the rooms a little more amenable to the size of the membership now. Mr. Chairman, Let me at the outset say that we align ourselves with the statement made by the Group of 77. And obviously we want to underline the importance of the Rio principles and the commitments made at the Rio Plus 20 summit. Mr. Chairman, let me start by saying that when we talk of the energy-water nexus, let's not forget and let's appreciate this fact quite clearly that the biggest challenge before the developing world is to provide energy and water to the millions who don't have it. We have 1.3 billion people in developing countries who do not have access to modern energy services, and more than 2.6 billion who still depend on firewood for cooking. IEA projections say that if business as usual continues, the situation won't improve even till 2030. Now, Mr. Chairman, let me highlight to you what I think is at least a two-step approach to trying and doing something about it. And the first is that we need to do something about where the energy-water nexus is available in plenty. And this is meaningful steps towards tackling the issue of unsustainable consumption and production and lifestyles in developed countries. This will also reduce the carbon footprint. And second, and this is my real very big and basic point, and I have been saying this at several fora, including recently at the technology workshop on the Rio Plus 20 follow-up. Mr. Chairman, we need to look for big-ticket technological solutions, solutions for which the developed world must put its heart and mind and soul into evolving these technologies using their vast array of technological research capabilities. And these solutions need to be used by them, deployed in their own countries. Believe me, there is no way that they will not reach across the world. Obviously, I would stand very firmly to suggest collaboration among those who have the greatest abilities and those who have the greatest needs, and some degree of willingness to share the fruits of science, technology, and innovation, while fully understanding that innovators need to be rewarded. Mr. Chairman, solar energy and wind energy were to the fore, and many and a few years back, they would have been the basics of conversations around in this room. But what do I find today? That most of them are getting mired in various kinds of sophisticated trade disputes. In terms of pure research, what do I find? That there is reluctance to really try and pursue huge, big-ticket research on how can we improve these? How can we do better storage? How can we do generation directly from the sun without going through the route of fossil fuels? And I find hesitation. I would like to spur that particular action and that particular sense of motivation among the developed world. And I would very much stress that we would all in the world be great beneficiaries of that. I would just like to, you know, make one example. A few years back, someone like me, in most of these negotiations, would be constantly harried on being asked to support carbon capture and storage. You know, we started this thing called the Carbon Sequestration Leadership Forum. I don't know where it's gone. This is the point that I'm trying to stress. And Mr. Chairman, I count on your massive powers that you have and more power to your elbows that we can do something in this context to try and also solve the energy-water nexus for the benefits of synergizing growth, the environment, a better planet, and better life for all of us. Let us in this context clearly understand that fossil fuels are here and fossil fuels are what are going to remain the champions of ensuring that we have a better life for ourselves in the future. We need to work on technological solutions which will enable us even to, what should I say, tackle this great conundrum of the energy and the carbon footprint nexus. Mr. Chairman, I want to stop. I want to thank you very much for convening this debate, and I sincerely hope that all of these will contribute to the United Nations in itself taking a lead in helping humankind look at various solutions for the benefit of us all. I thank you very much, sir.
I thank Ambassador Puri, the distinguished representative of India, also for reminding us about what a beautiful room the Trusteeship Council has become, and that indeed we are using it for a good purpose. And also thank Ambassador for all the good questions and also for your statements that give a lot of food for thought for the panel, that I'm sure they will address all of them when they will have the opportunity soon. is I now give the floor to the representative of Belarus.
Thank you very much, moderator. Belarus commends the initiative of the President of the General Assembly in convening this thematic debate on the nexus between water and energy. My delegation would like to comment on the statement by one of the speakers from this morning's session. We firmly believe that sustainable development should be considered very responsibly. This is a theme that requires a very integrated and sensitive approach. In such discussions, there is no place for hasty statements, rash statements. We would be grateful to the distinguished participant if such matters were brought up during this session. We do not have time for deep discussions of such multifaceted matters during a one-day session, thematic discussion at the United Nations. Belarus agrees with the fact that there is a close relationship between energy and water. In this context, we call upon the delegations of the member states, we call upon them to refrain from calling into question the link with such sensitive areas as nuclear energy, and to refrain also from attempts to demonize such sectors. In our European region, Eastern European region, winters are becoming extremely long and unpredictably so indeed. And in this context, we need to implement very well thought out solutions for energy supply at the global and regional level. Peaceful nuclear energy in Belarus is carried out with strict compliance with applicable international norms and obligations. Belarus, in preparing for the construction of atomic power stations, has prepared and on a timely basis submitted to the international community our assessment of the future site, the future facilities on the environment, environmental impact assessments. In accordance with this document, the construction of the atomic energy station will not have a substantial impact on the environment, on rivers, on forests, and so forth. Any substantiated data that would testify to the contrary, well, actually no such data has been provided by any of the neighbouring countries to Belarus. By way of conclusion, I would like to underscore on a separate note that the absence of progress on the negotiations on the Neman River is a source of concern to us. However, responsibility for the success of the negotiation process is borne by all of the participants in the negotiations equally. On our part, we look forward to cooperating with our partners and our neighbours in a more constructive spirit. Thank you very much, moderator.
I thank the representative of Belarus. And before I give the floor to Morocco, let me remind the reminding speakers that we have 3 minutes. So I just repeat that we should try to limit ourselves to 3 minutes. Then, Morocco, the floor is yours.
Merci, Monsieur le.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. At the outset, Morocco would like to commend the United Arab Emirates for their project focused on renewable energy. Morocco is undertaking similar measures. For example, our solar mega project, which is being launched in the south of Morocco, and which will be launched by 2019. And we will begin operations there in 2015. The scientific community has really placed the ball in the camp of the political decision makers, and I would like to put today's discussions into context. How can we build on international legal instruments, the international legal instruments that are available to us at this time, in order to make forward in the area of clean energy and also in the area of water? We have a number of international legal instruments. We have the International Agency for Renewable Energy, which is carrying out most excellent work. And we also will soon have the 15th United Nations Conference on Climate Change. This 15th conference should result in a legally binding agreement. In other words, Mr. Chairperson, human history, if you could compare it as follows, well, we have come up against two multinational walls. We had, first of all, the Berlin Wall, which was dismantled in 1989. And today we face a second wall, and that is the fossil fuels wall. This fossil fuels wall, will we succeed in dismantling it in 2015? The fossil fuels wall, we do need, as an international community, we do need to climb over it, and we need to do that via the United Nations Conventions on Climate Change, starting with the 1992 Convention. We have succeeded in tackling this wall on a number of occasions, but we've never managed to dismantle it. So the question is, will we succeed in dismantling the fossil fuel wall in 2015? The international community looks forward to the adoption of a binding legal instrument that will feed into the post-2015 development agenda. We need to reinvigorate the post-2015 development agenda. The outcome of the 15th United Nations Conference on Climate Change, will it lead to a new breakthrough in the post-2015 development agenda? Will the Secretary General's initiatives on energy for all, will that constitute a breakthrough? We need to the report, the Secretary General's report, needs to be implemented. Well, we could have a two-speed implementation, slow implementation at the initial stage, and then in the post-15 period, we could accelerate its implementation. Mr. Chairperson, the future cannot be predicted. The future is something that we build. We need to build the future by applying our political will to that endeavor. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed to the representative of Morocco. We are now facing a major challenge, and that is, how do we proceed? Because I would very much like also to have the panelists to respond to the questions that you have raised so far. And I would suggest that we do the following, that I now give the floor to the panelists, and then that the rest of the speakers will get the floor after that. That may actually have to be also when the next panel starts, or after. I see that you all are in agreement with my proposal, so then we move on. Very good, thank you. Then I will not try to guide the panelists in any detail, but just to sort of to say that, you know, I think the main question is that there are certain boundaries for the planet, and that we need to face that, and that so far the actions that we have taken have not been sufficient. That there seems to be a sort of global agreement about. The question is, do we now see that the work that has been initiated by the Secretary General and also by the Sustainable Development Group, do we see the possibility that we really can address it? And then when it comes to water and energy, what do we need to do? And I'm very much looking forward to hear the good answers to these very simple questions from the panel. And if you give good answers, we promise you that that will be in the report that Amina will write very soon. Is that agreeable, Amina?
Agreed.
That's very good. Then I suggest that we start again with the professor.
There is, alas, there are boundaries for the planet. The actions so far are indeed not sufficient. The prospects for actions in the near future that are sufficient are not very good, to understate it, I think. And therefore, I think in trying to come to a plan that grasps reality, one thing one might do is look to the sort of plan that was outlined for Cuba. And I noticed that in addition to a strong element for mitigation, there was also a very strong element for adaptation. And Cuba, like many Caribbean countries, has experience with natural disasters, hurricanes in particular, and Cuba in particular has done an excellent job of disaster preparedness. That's an extreme version of what needs to be done to allow for the, let's say, both the existing variations in climate, the existing variations in water and energy usage, and indeed the changes that we can expect in water and energy usage due to climate change and due to changing demands because of demographic changes and also economic development. So I would urge that the plan for the future contain a strong element of adaptation which takes account of the fact that climate variability and water variability in anyone's planning horizon will be powerfully influenced by natural variability of a sort that already exists and by the kind of projections that we can see that water in particular will become scarce in many places. That's a separate element that I would emphasize in addition to what strides we can make, and alas, they've been thoroughly inadequate toward mitigating climate change.
Thank you very much, Professor Kane. Then I give the floor to Mr. Cho.
To be short, I think first we have to recognize that the energy demand in the developing country still need to be increased because a lot of developing country have not yet got enough of the energy service that's necessary for their development. So the question is not that the developing country should or should not involve in the action to curbing climate change, but is to if we have enough technical measures or the sufficient mechanism to promote the low carbon economy. And so the second is we do need a group of country that have great impact on the economy of the world to take the lead. At this time, the developed countries still have the most important impact on the model of the market, of the consumption, of the technology innovation. So I do think the developed countries still should take the lead to combat the climate change. But of course, I think that all the countries, including developing countries, should to explore the low carbon development approach as well. For China, I think that we are really developed a serious study to look at when China can peak the greenhouse gas emission. And we make the progress on the technology feasibilities and policy feasibilities on if we can really peak the greenhouse emission before the 2030. And we all look at that if we do our best. And of course, it's related with the global environment and the conditions. We may get the greenhouse gas emission peak before 2030. And so that's that means we will not only to look at what we can do by 2020, but we will really think about the function of China in the global efforts to encourage the ambitions of the curbing climate change. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. As we all know, we will not be able to reach our goals if not China will be part of the solution. So we're looking forward to continued close cooperation with China. Samantha, the floor is now yours. You stressed at your previous intervention that a future was possible where all energy came from sustainable sources. You heard someone here today say that that is not really the case.
So as a civil society representative on this panel, I feel that it is also my duty to speak to the world we want, but I am not alone in this. I'd like to echo the remarks from the representative of Morocco, who said that we are in a transition towards a renewable future, and our chief challenge is how we are going to break down this wall of fossil fuels. There are numerous scientific studies, also, as we heard from Dr. Pachauri this morning, that show us that this transition is possible and that it also can be a just transition. The process of transitioning away from fossil fuels would take us away from the climate nightmare scenarios that we've seen, would create millions of jobs, would clean up our air, would empower women, and the list is extremely long. Now, you gave us a very specific question about how we can address both planetary boundaries, but also eliminating poverty. And how can we mobilize to address these two challenges, which are now deeply connected because people depend on resources, through this common work of post-2015 goals? I'd like to second the remarks of the representative of India, who pointed out that if we're really serious about achieving this transition, that it requires, rather than just competition between countries, it requires collaboration. It requires mobilization, the kind of mobilization that we saw in response to the financial crisis. It requires a mobilization that allows countries to use the tools of industrial policy and job creation. It requires, in fact, an environment where a country such as India that creates the solar emission is allowed to capture the value of those jobs and of all of the benefits that come with setting ambitious goals for solar power in your own country and trying to create manufacturing jobs without ending up in the WTO. On the issue of governance, we have a global goal on climate change. It's called the 2-degree target, as was pointed out earlier. But that cannot be our only tool. So in this process of post-2015, we actually have quite a good proposition, not an ambitious enough proposition, but a good proposition for a global goal on energy. It would be based on the UN Secretary General's Sustainable Energy for All initiative. And we support that kind of global goal because if we're going to do something about climate change, if we're going to bring energy to all of the people who do not have it today, we will need to have a global goal that focuses both on reducing consumption and increasing access, and finally on this massive transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy. Technology cooperation at scale is possible. We have seen it before in a range of areas. We see it also even in some of the biggest areas of innovation, such as IT. but funding is required. And again, if we look at the UN climate negotiations, what we see is that countries have created a bank without money. They've created a green climate fund, which is empty, where all of the countries that are now looking there to get money for this transition or for adaptation or for disaster response, they have to come away with empty hands because there is no money there. So that's another thing that will need to happen, is that countries have to live up to the commitments that they have made in multilateral negotiations. That includes money for the fund. Many speakers have focused on the need to prepare for climate change, to adapt and to fund disaster relief, and we certainly support that. But one thing that we also have to keep in mind, and something that we've heard over and over from the science that we've heard today, we're unable today to respond effectively to hunger crises and to natural disasters, to the extreme weather events that are caused by climate change. We're not able to keep people from starving to death. So if we're looking to a future where we're going to adapt our way out of climate change, that's not a future we want. We need a future where we are no longer living with the threat of accelerating numbers of natural disasters, more human catastrophes. We need also to invest in and to mobilize for this transition.
Thank you very much indeed, Samantha. Gisela, now the floor is yours. You have already received quite some praise for the work that Cuba is doing. And I'm sure you are prepared to tell us that you are willing to do even more.
No,
that's not what I was going to say. No, that's not what I want to say. I think that I was asked to speak mainly about Cuba, but I would now like to maybe comment on some of the other things that have been said here. I think this morning's session, it was quite clear that this is a global problem, a very serious problem that is a threat to humankind as a whole. And I think that this is something we have to bear in mind. Secondly, without a true solidarity and a change in the paradigm of consumption and production, to deal with certain issues that are related to common responsibility but differentiated responsibility, it will be, without that kind of change, it will be very difficult to cope with this problem for developing countries, and including my country, which is an island nation. We require true international cooperation and an integrated approach. Otherwise, it will be very difficult for us to cope with this. Furthermore, I think there's a concept that we have examined at the on the panel, and that is the post-2015, and the post-2015 panel, and that is to understand the individual responsibility that each individual has with regard to the future. I think there's a future generation there, young people, and we've spoken about the education of young people and youth employment, but it'll be very difficult to keep thinking about the future in the current conditions. And before I'm told to stop, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As you rightly said, these are global challenges. And Amina, you will be one of the persons who will sit and try to ponder about that global challenge in the next few weeks. From what you heard of the debate today and the panel discussion, are you optimistic?
I'm a born optimist. yes, I am. I think that from what we're here, clearly investing in water and the energy nexus, it makes people sense, planet sense, and business sense. And it is a critical part of what we'll have to succeed if we're talking about a development agenda that is universal and that has sustainable development at the core. But it is going to require more than political will. We hear about political will, but it's actually the political actions that we've heard in this room today that countries have taken that we've seen that transformation. And I think that we will have to support that. I appreciate what our permanent rep from deputy permanent rep from India had said in setting priorities. And those priorities really, there is a tension between lifestyles and the livelihoods. Many of us are still talking about livelihoods And if we don't want for our growth, for those livelihoods to turn into the lifestyles that we're trying to change, then we are going to have to look at setting priorities. And the transition will require collaboration of partnerships that is willing to do that. Somebody has got to foot the bill. So access, again, to the technologies, to the partnerships and resources that will be required for this are going to be key to make this next development agenda and this part of it work. I think another part that hasn't been spoken about but is essential, and we speak about it, Professor Sachs is leading that, is that how do we ensure that we've got research at the local level that finds the solutions to respond to these as we begin to implement this agenda post-2015? That's been missing. There's a huge amount of work that's been done on that front, and I believe that that's going to be critical to making this work. So, yes, optimistic, and I do know that, as I said, let's not talk about the trade-offs, but by how, in an integrated manner, over the next 15 years, we can begin a transition that's sustainable.
Then I want to thank you all. I think this has been a very useful discussion, reminding us that, indeed, we have a lot of knowledge. There is a lot of technology out there that we need to share. And there will be quite a few challenges. One of them is indeed the funding that has been alluded to. But we know that the key here is, you know, to be able to fight poverty. We need to address the nexus of energy and water, and that there are 1.3 billion people out there with no access to energy. And to work on that, we need to establish a partnership. We need renewable energy sources. And indeed, we need more efficiency. I wish you a continued good discussion, and also that we join forces together to be able to achieve the goals we all need to achieve. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We have an hour left, so perhaps if we can all take our seats, we have a limited time for the final panel, so we can get the presentations and discussion underway and finalize what has been a very interesting day. This morning session, we had a series of very intensive presentations presenting the problem of climate change and environmental degradation in the most graphic forms. I think somebody even called it nightmare. It succeeded in scaring us all stiff. So we thought in this panel that what we would try to do, and the members of this panel are all dealing with practical issues, is to look at where are the solutions, where are the possibilities of change, what is happening out there in a more dynamic sense. And I'm delighted to have with me a number of distinguished panelists who from their particular sectors will address these issues. My name is Adnan Amin. I'm Director General of the International Renewable Energy Agency based in Abu Dhabi. A relatively new agency, but one of the fastest growing organizations in the world. We have now 160 members in 2 years' time, and the growth of budget we have, I know this is a rather difficult thing to apprehend in the UN, but our budget has been growing at the rate of 25% a year. I think that attests to the fact that action is ongoing and there's a tremendous amount of interest among member states in the energy transition to come, and we'll discuss that a little bit later. I'd like to introduce the panel very quickly, so we can do that now. You have a sense of who we have here with us. I want to start with Her Excellency Razan Khalifa Al Mubarak. Razan is an inspirational young leader for the Environment Authority of Abu Dhabi. I've come to know her personally over the last few years that I've been in Abu Dhabi, and the energy and vision and drive that she has brought to the sustainability issue, the management of Abu Dhabi's water, energy, and environmental nexus has been truly remarkable. And we'll put her on the spot and ask her a few questions about that a little later. But we also have Professor Vijay Modi. Vijay is a professor of mechanical engineering at Columbia University. He has a plethora of awards. I won't list all of them, but what I will say is that he has been one of those from the scientific and academic environment who has been engaged in international discussions and in taking forward specific action-oriented initiatives on energy and water in developing countries, and I'm sure that he'll be able to share those with us. We also have Mr. Brice Lalonde. I think he's well known to everybody here. He is currently Special Advisor on Sustainable Development to the UN Global Compact, but I think most recently he was Executive Coordinator for the Rio Plus 20 process, so I'm sure that he has some traumatic moments to share with us from that process. But he has been Minister of Minister of Environment in France. He has been the French climate ambassador in the past and held a number of very important positions in the French government. Last but not least is Jeff Seabright, Vice President for Environment and Water Resources, Coca-Cola. Jeff is really on the forefront of looking at new corporate strategies to deal with natural resource issues, and in particular, as you can imagine, Coca-Cola actually uses quite a bit of water in its operations and energy to process that water. And I think that the emerging models of sustainable use that we are seeing in the corporate world, practical examples are actually very, very interesting. So we'll ask him to look at some of those. But let me start by saying a couple of words on renewable energy. It's actually something I deal with on a daily basis, so perhaps I can address some of the questions that came up on this. Here you have an industry that, which 10 years ago was considered a niche industry, is now mainstream. The last 3 years, the highest capacity additions to international power generation were from renewable energy. It's not an ephemeral thing or a dream out there. We have now emerging markets in China, Brazil, India, South Africa, and many parts of the developing world that are growing faster than any market in the world for renewable energy. We have research and development processes that are ongoing that are lowering the cost and increasing the efficiency of renewable energy. Over the last 3 years, we have seen a 75% reduction in the cost of solar photovoltaics. Solar photovoltaics are grid competitive anywhere in the world today. Wind, onshore wind, is grid competitive anywhere in the world. And we've seen with recent pioneering policy initiatives in Brazil and South Africa, for example, with capacity auctions for renewable energy, that the cost of renewable energy, especially of solar and wind, has gone below that of gas and coal. So there are some very interesting processes going on. So when we look at that big picture, that we are all going to be buried by tsunamis and in a very serious situation, it's true. It would be true if other things were not happening that are preparing us for the future. And I think those are happening in very practical ways, and sometimes it's good to penetrate the ivory tower of the United Nations to look at the practical things so you can actually see that there are actors out there, and perhaps when you design your new global frameworks in the future, you will take account of what's actually happening on the ground in terms of the change that's being generated. But I'll ask Jeff Seabright first to talk about his experiences at Coca-Cola, very fascinating modalities they've developed, both for natural resource accounting in their operations as well as the efficiency which they handle their things. But I just want to refer to an anecdote he told me just before we came on. It was with the president of Coca-Cola a few years ago, where Jeff was presenting scenarios about water stress and all the problems this would entail and so on. I won't repeat the exact language, because in the American corporate world they use words that we cannot use in the General Assembly of the UN. But she said, "I am very tired of having new ways of admiring the problem. Tell me what I can do about it." So, Jeff, what can we do about it?
Great. Well, thank you very much. And it's a great honor for me personally and for the Coca-Cola Company to be asked to join this this very important discussion today. You know, obviously for us at the Coca-Cola Company, we operate in over 200 countries and territories around the world with about 1,000 manufacturing facilities that are franchisees, locally owned partners of the Coca-Cola system. And we use water in everything that we do. We're the world's largest beverage company. And as a result of that, we've really had to learn and understand a great deal about this shared resource that's under growing stress. And we see that stress. We've done, you know, extensive research and work across our global operations to understand this risk of water and the increasing stress. And for us, it is an exercise in really going from looking at the operational footprint of our manufacturing operations, so the traditional focus on water efficiency, wastewater treatment, and water quality, things that we have been doing for many, many years, and really beginning to ask the question, well, where is this water coming from, which then gets you into looking at watersheds and ecosystems and understanding that, in fact, the largest part of our supply chain is provided by nature, natural capital, watersheds. And so we need to understand how those watersheds are being managed and who the shared users in those watersheds are, farmers, others, and to make sure that as we approach our business, that we're not doing it in a way that is challenging other users in that watershed, and that we're doing that in a collaborative way to create shared benefits and shared outcomes. And the reason this is so important, and I've seen really the water issue just continue to grow in the corporate sector over the last 5 to 7 years, there may be a beyond petroleum, you know, with a world fueled by renewable sources, but there is no beyond water. Not for Coca-Cola, not for any living being on the planet. So getting this right is actually so fundamental that we really do have to get on with it. So some of the things that we're doing, we have really focused on water efficiency. We have cut water use by 20% over the last 7 years, saved $650 million. We're targeting an additional 25% reduction in water intensity. We've pioneered zero discharge water reuse systems in India and Mexico, two countries that are extremely water stressed, and we're now in the process of replicating that technology and taking it out across our operations in other parts of the world. The challenge is by efficiently reusing water, you tend to use more energy, just like desalinization uses energy. And so you have a bit of this trade-off between energy use versus water, and so that's a bit of a challenge. We also have engaged in a goal that by 2020 we will effectively give back both to communities and watersheds as much water as we use, and we're tracking that year on year openly and transparently in a methodology that we work with many others in the NGO community to and business to establish. And we're at about 52% offset today. And how do we do that? We do it through reforestation. We do it through rainwater harvesting projects in communities. We do it through engaging in drip irrigation with farmer cooperatives. And through that, we're really working in about 100 countries with over 500 projects with a whole range of partners, including UNDP. And then lastly, and just sort of maybe finish on this, is this whole question of valuing natural capital. I mean, watersheds are a very critical part of this discussion. We've been engaged actively, primarily in Latin America, around payment for environmental services. So, you know, understanding that there's a real economic value to us of protecting the ecosystem, the watershed that sustains our business, and investing along with other business users to make sure that we protect that watershed rather than waiting until it becomes resource constrained or the quality is diminished, and then we have to pay even more in order to treat the water to make it to the kinds of standards that we require. So maybe I'll stop there. There are many other things I'd love to touch on, but in the interest of time.
Thank you very much. I think what's particularly interesting is the natural capital aspect and how corporations the size of yours, I understand there's another one called something like Pepsi, which is also doing something similar, but where corporations can actually start costing natural resource use in their operations in a very different way, and what that means for the business model in the future, since the private sector is one of the biggest users of these resources. So I think that's a very transformational issue, and maybe we can go into that a little bit later. Now, we've heard a view from the private sector. We have somebody from a government, Razan, representing the Abu Dhabi Environment Authority. Abu Dhabi is a very particular place in a water-stressed, arid region, but enacting very enlightened new policies in terms of energy, waste, environmental management. You've all heard of the Masdar program for renewable energy, but Razan is at the forefront of looking at the nexus issues on many of this. And from your perspective, Razan, where do you see the changes that are most hopeful for the future?
Thank you. I mean, I think it's always important to recognize that this challenge of balancing the energy and water nexus is indeed present in all nations. And it's also, but the form of the challenge obviously differs depending on the prevailing conditions of any nation, any region, and indeed any corporation. But it's also very, very difficult to speak about this nexus without really talking and bringing in the issues of climate change, the issues of food production, and of course the twin drivers of population growth and economic development. So as you were saying, from a UAE perspective, what we tried to do, and very similar to what the Indian representative also talked about, is really looking at some of the priorities and how we should first understand them from a local perspective and therefore able to manage them in a more effective manner. So as you were saying, the UAE is indeed located in an arid region. So our only source of water is actually groundwater. Our groundwater was laid down in the last ice age. So essentially, it's a non-renewable resource. So for us, groundwater is the only freshwater reserve that can provide for long-term water security. today, while there are many things that are going well, but it's also important to admit when things aren't going so well. Our groundwater use is unsustainable. It accounts for 60% of our total water consumption, and that's mainly used for agriculture. But agriculture only represents 10% of our food requirement. So from a solution perspective, desalination is an obvious solution for our natural water shortage, and it's our main source of potable water. However, as we all know, desalination is energy intensive, contributing to increased GHG emission, but it also discharges brine to the marine environment, also deteriorating marine water quality, and is, of course, is a significant economic investment. While our desal plants are cogeneration plants, they generate both water and electricity, making them efficient. However, during the summer months, when we have an increased demand for electricity, we produce excess water, which is very difficult to store in a region that where freshwater storage, surface freshwater storage is not an option. But we talk here about solutions. And Professor Jeffrey Sachs really outlined some of the major areas where we really need to work on. And essentially, it's diversifying our energy base. So by 2030, 30% of our electricity will come from low-carbon sources. But that will help us also decouple water and electricity production so that we're better able to manage them based on the centers of demand. But there are other more simple things to do, like managing our energy and water demand. One example that I can talk about now is a comprehensive cooling plan in all Abu Dhabi buildings. This comprehensive plan is projected to reduce between 30 to 48% of energy. That is 14% of total energy demand. Over 10 years, the projected savings are over $9 billion and over 10 million tons of carbon dioxide savings. I can speak more on that, but I'll leave the floor to the rest of the speakers and hopefully have the chance to give you more examples later. Thank you.
And, you know, when we look at the interface between energy and water, there are the obvious issues that we all know that, you need energy for pumping, water distribution, desalination, drinking water preparation. You need water for irrigation, for hydropower, for pump storage, and so on. But there are some trends that you see in the interrelationship that are truly disturbing, or, on the other hand, opportunities where change can be made. For example, in the U.S. alone uses 520 billion kilowatt hours to move, treat, heat its water, which accounts for up to 60% of the energy bill in many cities and up to 90% of on-farm energy expenditure. And about 13% of the entire electricity use in the U.S., which is about 290 metric tons of carbon, is used for this purpose. So, you know, there are many more fundamental relationships. There are low-hanging fruits. For example, in England and Wales, I saw a fascinating statistic. In 2010 to 2011, you know, there's very old infrastructure in England and Wales, 2,600 megaliters of water, which is the equivalent of 1 million liters, were lost per day through leaky pipes, wasting the energy expenditure for transporting and treating that drinking water. So on the one hand, we are dealing with an environment that is very threatening. On the other hand, we continue not to invest in infrastructural improvement that can have massive payoff. Vijay, let me turn to you. You're an engineer. You've been dealing with energy and water in many settings. In developing countries, where do you see the critical challenges and where do you think the transition can come to take us forward?
First of all, thank you. And great question. I want to first start by saying that there are 1 billion people without access, right, for water and energy. But I want to highlight one aspect. we talk about drinking water, but drinking water per capita is about 15 meter cube per year. But the marginal food production that came from intensification of land in places like India, which will have to also happen in sub-Saharan Africa, came from relying on pumping water. Now, if you do that, and if you look at the 70 to 80 million tons of food produced in India from irrigation, that's using roughly 1 kilowatt hour for each kilogram of food produced. So even the basic food requirement for a person, that's a couple of hundred meter cube of water, an order of magnitude higher than drinking. And the same is for energy. I use a rough number that in the very bottom of the pyramid, per capita, 50 kilowatt hours for lighting, communication, TV. But for irrigation, it is 500 kilowatt hours. So there's that order of magnitude difference. Now, the positive side of the story is that many countries pulled this off. They managed to get, you know, their seed, fertilizer, water, energy all aligned to produce this substantial amount of food. But, you know, in a patchy settings, there were mistakes made too, where there are over withdrawals and so on. Now, are there opportunities to be more efficient there? And that's your question? Absolutely. So when we did theoretical calculations of just the theoretical requirement of water, so if you were able to perfectly irrigate a crop during its perfect water demand, and you were able to very efficiently apply energy to do that, versus what is happening today, you see a factor of 8. Now, you're not going to be able to make that 8-fold improvement overnight, but we see that factors of 2 or 3 are possible in those settings. So that's one. And the second point I want to make is you alluded to large leakages of water in distribution systems. But the real underlying problem you are alluding to is last mile discipline in distribution, whether this is energy or water. Now, in many situations, we had utilities which either due to not the greatest management of the utility or through political interference of a parastatal, the utility was not allowed to collect a proper tariff for its service, or the government did not compensate the utility for what was a public good. In either case, then the reliability started to suffer. As reliability started to suffer, people paid even less to the utility. Then the reliability got even worse. So you got in a vicious cycle of lowering reliability and at the same time utility losing the ability to make investments. Now, what we found, we did 16 deployments of mini-grids in Africa, 8 in Mali and 8 in Uganda. But what we found amazing was that if you were providing reliable service, even the poor were willing to pay. So how can we move away from that negative vicious circle to a positive feedback where you have reliability, you have the ability to deliver good quality service, and it turns out if you are able to do that, then you are able to attract the investments to make the improvements in efficiency, lowering costs through integrating renewables, and so on. Now, it will require lower cost finance than what's currently available. But I think through that, you know, if you're looking at it as a chicken and egg situation, I think that having last mile discipline, distribution discipline, can actually kickstart that positive cycle. So I'm going to stop there, but, you know, later can come back.
Thank you, Vijay. You know, there are big trends that are happening that have the potential to change things in big ways. we were having a conversation at lunch about where we see the growth prospects for renewable energy. It has a lot to do with how governments are going to invest in infrastructure in the future, because you have to move renewable energy, which is generated in areas where you don't have traditional grids, and you have to get it to demand centers. So, you know, it looks like a big problem, but if you look at what's actually happening, the coming change is hugely consequential. Let's just take the case of Africa. We have a situation where we have done a thorough resource assessment of renewable energy sources along the whole East and Southern African corridor running along the Great Rift Valley. We have the best solar, the best wind, the best geothermal, the best hydro potential in the world. Investments have already started to happen. In my country, in Kenya, we have just inaugurated the first $700 million wind project. That's the first wind project for which we already built the infrastructure for a 200-kilometer corridor of the best wind resource in the world. That entire resource is available. The problem is we don't have roads. We cannot carry the turbines there. But that infrastructure is now in place. Every subsequent investment is going to be that much cheaper in the future. And as we build transmission interconnection between the different African countries, we will create an energy market in which the biggest investors in the world are able to participate. So I think there's a transformation there coming. I was with colleagues in Saudi Arabia, oil-producing country. All of you know it as only from that perspective. But what we see today in Saudi Arabia is the elementary equation they have made, that their domestic energy consumption is going up at such a price that there are projections that by 2035 they might become net energy importers. Their current cost equation for the utilization of their fossil fuels in country is that the subsidized cost of electricity and gas means that there's a lost opportunity cost of $90 for every barrel that's not exported. If they are able to utilize their renewable energy resource domestically and export their oil and gas, you have a completely changed economic model in Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia is looking at it also from the perspective of not only investing massively domestically. The first investment of $120 billion, 40 gigawatt generation, has already broken ground. But they are looking at developing transmission infrastructure that's going to link the Gulf region. Abu Dhabi is another country that's investing heavily with the demand centers in Europe and in Asia. If that happens, this region will become the next big energy importer on the basis of clean energy. And I think these are revolutionary potential developments that are happening, and in every part of the world you can find something like that. Now, let me have one last very quick round from each of you. Jeff, when you look at the private sector and when you look at corporations like yours, which are looking at how to do the future, it's not just an issue of corporate social responsibility where you're trying to tell us we're good guys so we buy your products. It's actually a new way of doing business. How do you think that's going to impact operations for big corporations in the future?
Well, thank you. I've seen a steady increase in the sort of the corporate world over the last five or so years on this topic, really understanding that there are some very significant resource constraints, and this nexus issue has really brought it to the fore. You know, Shell Oil has done a scenario around the food, energy, water nexus. I chaired the Global Advisory Council of the Agenda Council of the World Economic Forum on water security, and we published a food, water, energy, climate nexus study back in 2009. And these are leading companies contributing to this thinking. So it's not just a question of CSR or sort of philanthropy. It's a question of understanding what are the key underlying challenges that are going to shape the sort of the landscape that we as businesses and we as a society are going to have to navigate in the 21st century. Because, you know, while businesses are often criticized for managing to, you know, quarter to quarter, that actually is more about Wall Street here. We actually plan long-term because we intend to stay in business long-term, and balancing long-term, short-term is a key element of success in business. If you just live for the short term, you won't have a long term. And so really understanding. And so we've been looking at water issues, food security for the first time. We reported in the U.S. Corporate disclosure requirements of Sarbanes-Oxley, talked about food security and challenges around climate change and water as material risks to our business. And so as we understand these as business risks, the solutions that we're putting in place don't get cut when the budgets get cut, because it's about the business. It's not about philanthropy. It's not a nice-to-do or check-the-box compliance. It's about building the right kind of business to go the distance. And so that means really understanding these challenges and working across business. So it's not just a question of my company. It's a question of what other companies working with civil society, working with NGOs like WWF, which is just up on this dais, and with governments can do together, because together we can solve these challenges. Independently, it's very hard to see how we're going to get the kind of financing, the scale of change. And we know that the business community has the human and technological and innovative capital to help drive these solutions, but it has to be in partnership.
Give me the Razan, your country is in a fairly envious situation where you have the fiscal space to actually be able to do things in a new and innovative way. That's why an oil economy would start to invest in renewable energy. You have tremendous growth and development happening in the country. Where do you think the transformational issues in the field of energy, water, sustainability lie? What foresight do you have looking at that? And as you confront the specter of global change, how are you preparing yourselves for that?
It's a very big question. Thank you for that. But we've been talking really across four paradigms. So we're looking at how do you diversify your supply? We talked about how do you better manage your demand? But we also talked about the opportunities in terms of research and development. And I think that's something that we should be spending a little bit more time on. There's tremendous opportunity there. We listened to how the price of the of solar energy has gone down tremendously. And again, it's a very important signal to look at and keep an eye on. And in one of the areas from a R&D perspective that was launched also earlier this year in Abu Dhabi, again, the rationale can be very different from every nation, depending, again, on the prevailing conditions, and that's fine. But for us, water is a real issue. It's a real challenge. It's a real shortage. And I believe that it's the scarcity that actually pushes innovation. So we've just launched in January a pilot program to test and deliver energy efficiency desalination plants powered by renewable energy for the long-term goal to have an operational at a commercial scale plant to be implemented in Abu Dhabi by 2020. The other area that I think from a kind of forecast or essentially foresight perspective is all of these are really good examples of individual projects that address the nexus. But really, to take the management of the nexus to the next level, we need to have a nexus approach to planning and decision making. And I think that's really important. And I'm happy to say that in Abu Dhabi, we started again looking at that dimension of whole of government planning. We just released an integrated policy framework called the Environment 2030. And the objective for that is to get the various sectors within the government to think, plan, and decide together by looking at the very real challenges that are facing us, but also look at the trade-offs and the opportunities this nexus presents.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me turn to Vijay, because Razan just identified nexus decision-making. And you're working in many developing countries, which are really in water stress situation, which are really looking for energy access as a very basis for future development. How do you see the nexus decision making in that setting?
Let me give you a couple of examples to be very concrete about it and how the nexus thinking is being thought through. So in my work in Western India, there are utilities which have 55 to 60% of their entire electricity go for pumping water. So the nexus thinking that these utilities are doing is, if you, now first of all, they are also challenged to install new power plants quickly. So the only power plants they can get quickly are actually solar PV power plants. So they're looking at how they can schedule irrigation to be in sync with the availability of the sun. So storing water in the soil becomes a mechanism of storing energy, because a crop or a plant or can deal with that issue on a sort of diurnal basis. So if it does not matter whether it was early in the morning or afternoon, because it's getting irrigated after 10 or 12 days. So that's one at a very utility level. But at a larger regional level, country level like India, or a regional level in Africa, some of the thinking that is beginning and I think needs to be strengthened, as my colleague from Abu Dhabi said, is that there are ways in which solar and wind, if you think through the issues of transmission and storage at a large scale. Imagine the Himalayas with offering great opportunities of topography for pumped hydro, where you do not no longer need to store water for weeks or months in large reservoirs, but actually much shorter term storage on a diurnal cycle, because the diurnal cycle is what the solar supply deals with. So if you start to then start to sort of green sheet thinking your infrastructure for a 20-year, 30-year ahead, you can actually start to think through where would you be locating your best generation, where would you be locating your storage, but more importantly, how would you be operating that storage so that you get the most value out of it, without storing large amounts of water as in conventional large storage dams. So just giving you a couple of examples there. And I want to just end with a third example from a very operational perspective, is with energy and water, when you start to look at sustainable solutions, you need to measure, meter, and manage operations. And that has conventionally in the past been left to arcane rules that were written in books that whenever the dam is at this height, do this or something like that. With sensing, wireless communication, automation, we are finding that you can actually be far more nuanced about how to operate these things. You can reduce transaction costs. You can reduce the kind of costs of storage that are involved and bring operational efficiency to the place. So just three examples.
Good. So if we put the day in context, we had very powerful, almost overwhelming messages since the morning about the scale and the planetary dimension of the challenge that we're facing. And, you know, when you're faced with problems of such an overwhelming character, it can be a little disempowering also, because, you know, the temptation is to say, okay, there's this stuff happening, there's nothing I can do about it, let me just carry on with my business, and, you know, if it's going to be a problem, let it come, maybe somebody will find a solution and so on. But I think as we've gone through the day, what we are seeing is that the way we are going to address these problems is not by trying to cut back on everything, do less, and constrain ourselves. It's by looking for the opportunities for transformational change through which we can address the problems, but we can also improve the lifestyles, living conditions of the overwhelming population of this world. And I think that's the elements that are beginning to come out of this. And, you know, I left the UN a few years ago, and I've felt liberated because I can say things which I never would have said when I was a UN official. So let me posit an issue to the distinguished delegations here. You have this very intensive discussion going on about what the global frameworks are going to be for the future. It has become so arcane, and there are so many tracks that even the two staff members I have monitoring this have lost sight and have no idea what's going on anymore and just put them onto something else. How you know, Brees, you've been dealing with these issues for many years, and your last comeback on this. What can we do to inject into a process like that the clarity of what opportunities need to be supported for change, the universality in the sense that these transformational possibilities are available and can be participated in by all? And how can we look at a new generation of these kind of goals? I know I'm asking you this and you're beginning to shrink in your seat. But do you think this is an issue that needs to be addressed in this process? And how do you think that could be done?
Thank you, Adnan. That's very nice and kind of you. I don't know. But what I think is, when I heard Mr. Puri lately, you know, he was a bit sad because carbon capture and sequestration did not work, and after, let's go back to fossil fuels. No, you have to be persistent. I mean, this is a process, a transition, which has started 40 years ago, and this is going to go on. And you have to keep on doing that. I mean, that's the way it is. And I was very, I'm impressed because, beside Coca-Cola, Abu Dhabi, lots of things are happening. It's quite true. And I can confirm that now we know that the time of easy energy and easy water is over. Lots of companies now, they recognize that. They have introduced that in their own business model. In the Global Compact, we have 7,000 companies who are doing extraordinary things, very spectacular results. We've got a group called Caring for Climate, which goes to every conference of the party, and all the good practices, we're trying to diffuse them. We've got the water mandate. We're going to have a meeting in September to try to scale up everything in a new architecture of a better world. So things are happening, but it's true that this, you have to, I mean, you know, it's difficult and complicated because energy and water, it's quite technical. And lots of politicians are not accustomed to these political things. They don't know how to handle them. So it's absolutely true that you need to have planning. We have a lack of governance in most of our issues. And this means that in each place, because it goes somewhere, energy is for people, water goes for people somewhere. So you have to have a plan. First, you have to have your climate modeling. You have to have a good climate modeling team to tell you what's going to happen and how it could be. Second, you have to have a sort of a decision-making participatory. You need to have everybody involved, otherwise it's not going to work. And this is something which is so important now. You need to have accounting for energy and water in your measurements. That's the footprint, water footprint, carbon footprint. It must be mandatory. Everybody has to get to it. You need to have integrated plans and you need to empower local governments. And in your plans, you have to start by the supply side, the demand side. Sorry, mistake. The demand side, because what is it for? It's for agriculture. You've got so many ways of saving energy and saving water. And agriculture can be independent for energy. I mean, completely independent. It's a plan. Each country can work on it and do it. City planning, so important. It's all now, you've got all these new contracts between utilities and people. You can, the utilities pay, you know, it's the gigawatt, okay, the gigawatt. It's so important. Utilities pay for the households to save energy, and you can repay, if you want, your loans on your bill, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of techniques now, which you have to know, you have to diffuse everybody. It's working very well. And you need meters. Oh, how simple it is. Meters, okay? You need meters to know how much you're consuming. And you can even have smart meters. And you can even have prepaid meters. Ooh, terrible. I mean, lots of things which are so simple. You can start that way, and after things are going to get so much better. Of course, we know that there is a sensitive political issue on paying the price of water, the price of the service to bring the water. In our consultant world, when I was a consultant, we shared the secret. Never have the price of water more than 2% of the revenue of the people. So depending on the revenue of the people, never more than 2%. And the other, well, financing, tax, transfer, solidarity, lots of ways of financing. Let me tell you just a few things on the supply side. Infrastructure. Yes, nature is the first infrastructure. So take care of nature, because nature can clean the water. You need to respect the flooding plains. Lots of techniques and things like that that people do not know about. Politicians do not know the cycle of water. They have to learn it. And something this is new. And after dams, for instance, all the dams, you can elevate the dams with crests, with spillovers and fuse gates and things like that. Lots of things can be done. Adnan, look, if you want, lots of dams are used to store electricity because it's one of the problems. And so you pump the water up, but you can have on your lake floating solar cells, which are going to pump the water up all the time, so you're going to always have water for electricity. Lots of things. So one of the big issues is storage, because as you know, you cannot store electricity. Oh, bother. We didn't need it because after we had the jerrycans of oil, so it was so easy to go around with. Storage and storage of water. Storage of water does not mean dam. It can be dam. It means water harvesting. It means catchment areas. There is a Mexican guy who has invented something extraordinary. It's called Silos de Agua. I don't know how you pronounce that.
Heavens of water. Skies of water, heavens of water.
Yes. It means this guy, he has took the technology of diapers. Incredible diapers. And he has put some powder in the water. The water gets solid. And you can put the solid water in the earth, and it keeps for half a year. And the plant takes it. You have a lot. You have a windmill which captures the water of the air, the moisture of the air, and you have water coming from the windmill. Lots of techniques are coming right now. So exciting and so interesting, which you need to spend. Nobody knows about it. And, of course, you need... Look, stones. You put stones in some very arid places. You put stones on the contour lines. I cannot pronounce contour lines. So difficult for a Frenchman. Okay. You put stones, but how do you get the contour lines? A GPS. So the GPS comes to help to rescue the oldest simple technology to keep moisture in the soil. So lots of things are happening like that. And, of course, you have the high tech, you have the smart grids. And the third thing, which is getting more and more important, is reuse the water. Reuse the water. Now, especially in our modern cities, we clean the water so much. You throw it away. How stupid. Can't we don't reuse it? This is so important. Reusing water is going to be one of the main source of water in the future. So, Adnan, I don't really know how the huge framework is going to come. It's true that we started top-down, and now we see that we have a huge amount of bottom-up approaches, which are so interesting. But business wants a global framework. Because business is fed up with regulations different from one country to another, and they have to, the aviation tax is there, another tax. Can't we have an agreement? So I think, something new is happening. You're quite right to say. Something new is happening is all the actors want to help the politicians to go fast. And perhaps in the United Nations system, perhaps one day, all the distinguished representatives of states will try also to think of the planetary interests and not only the national interests. Thank you so much. I shouldn't say that.
Bravo.
Can you press that button?
Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Brees. With all that Gaelic enthusiasm and energy, I was getting worried about your neighbors, but they're safe. But, I think what this goes to indicate is that there is something new happening. I think the fact that we're having this debate here is very interesting because it comes at a time when new methodologies for international cooperation are being discussed. And I think that the point that this panel would try to make in that setting is please look at reality before you come with top-down solutions and see what the transformational opportunities out there and what role the international institutions can play to support those. We don't expect the international institutions to do them for any country. but how do you create the enabling environment and the support framework for it to happen? That's what we need from you who are discussing all of these important issues over the next days. It's very reassuring to be back at the UN and seeing not much has changed, because we were discussing an interactive debate, but we have a speakers list coming from this morning. So I've been told by our secretary that we have to go to our speakers list, and we'll start with the distinguished representative of Malaysia, please.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator, for giving me the floor. I would like to thank the PGA for convening this important debate and the panelists for the excellent presentation today. Many speakers have highlighted the importance of energy and water nexus in meeting the challenges of climate change. In this regard, Malaysia is no exception, and we have taken a number of initiatives to find practical and sustainable solutions to make development more effective and more sustainable, which I would like to briefly share. When we talk about green technology, it is often inextricably linked to energy efficiency. There is huge potential for developing countries, as highlighted by some speakers, to implement meaningful energy efficiency initiatives. Even the simple measures of banning incandescent lamps would result in much energy savings, and that the efficiency energy is an effective and efficient policy instrument that can offer an excellent solution to reduce our energy demand and at the same time retain our improve the benefits derived from energy utilization. Some of the initiatives include helping energy users to identify and attain energy savings potential, promoting market penetration of energy-efficient appliances in various sectors, as well as improvements in buildings through enhancements of building code. One of the main challenges in driving the renewable energy or RE industry is making it commercially attractive to investors. This is what this topic is about, especially when competing with the fossil fuel-based technology, which was discussed earlier. This is where government intervention is required to put in place business-friendly regulatory frameworks and financing mechanisms to promote renewable energy. In order to accelerate the development of renewable energy in Malaysia, we have launched the feed-in tariff that came into effect in December 2011. It is one of the most effective mechanism to promote renewable energy, and we understand that it has been successfully implemented in some developed countries. Apart from the energy efficiency and renewable energy, we have taken a plethora of initiatives to promote green growth, that is green buildings, green transportation, smart cities, and etc. In this regard, Malaysia intends to transform its administrative capital, Putrajaya, and its cyber city, Cyberjaya, into smart cities. Malaysia has also launched its electric vehicles initiatives, and it plans to have 10% of all new passenger cars to be electric vehicles by 2020. As one of the panelists said earlier, due to climate change, we cannot expect the same pattern of rainfall in the future. In this regard, Malaysia also, although blessed with ample rain, is in the process of restructuring its water and sewerage industries to enhance efficiency and conservation. Given the changes of weather patterns, Malaysia cannot take its current endowment for granted. Last but not least, Malaysia is currently embarking on a holistic structural reform of the electricity supply industry to ensure its sustainability and its ability to contribute to the nation's long-term socio-economic goals. I thank you, Mr. Moderator.
Thank you very much. Thank you, distinguished representative of Malaysia, for his remarks. We now have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We have 7 states asking for the floor. We have 8 minutes left to the end of the session. We have a heartfelt plea from the secretary of this committee that written statements should be distributed to the secretariat so they can be put on the website and they can be read in their full glory on the website. But what we would ask and plead to the remaining speakers is if you could make succinct remarks on the subject of the thematic debate and try to enable others to speak also before the time runs out from the debate. So having said that, let me look at my distinguished friend from Saudi Arabia to see if he can set the example for brevity.
Mr. Chairperson, our meeting today is an important opportunity to review and strengthen national and international effort in order to achieve the objective sought by the entire international community, especially as we approach the year 2015, the year of the achievement of the Millennium Goal development. In this regard, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is committed to advancing sustainable development goals in the area of energy, water, and climate change, and it is committed to implement the diversification of its economy in a manner that will achieve the co-benefits of the global adaptation and mitigation ambitions. Saudi Arabia is rich in natural resources, including solar, wind, and promising dense thermal energy. King Abdullah City for Atomic and Renewable Energy, established in the year 2010, is just an example of the leadership of Saudi Arabia has taken in its transitional phase towards increasing mix in energy for sustainable energy and development. In addition to its effort to achieve diverse economy, this step includes the launch of large investment to develop a technical capacity and human resource needed to build a vital economic sector and a new focus on integrated energy. The Kingdom invested heavily in renewable energy that they were working through research and development and the technical innovation and in sectorial partnership to build a new generation of sustainable energy generation capacity for the exploitation of renewable energy for renewable and long-term electricity supply. As for the future status of water in the Kingdom, the Institute of Research and Desalination Techniques had numerous achievements, including the discovery of a new method for desalination for soil water using membrane filtration with traditional method of desalination. This discovery led to the increase of the percentage of extraction of fresh water from 50% to 70% compared to the traditional method. The Kingdom considers the importance of alternative and renewable energy, especially desalination, solar, and water resource. The Kingdom of the King Abdulaziz City for Science and Technology had earlier announced the launch of the National Initiative for the Desalination of Solar Water. The initiative aimed to find technical solution and lower cost to contribute to the national economy and the development of advanced technology through this joint center for research and nanotechnology between the city and IBM Global. Mr. Chairperson, we would like to stress the discussion of the climate change should remain in the specialized and primary forum of the UNFCCC. Furthermore, while Saudi Arabia recognizes the importance of sustainable development, it is crucial to maintain the principles of Rio and Agenda 21, especially the principle of CBDR, when discussing this issue. In addition, we emphasize that developing countries must fulfill their prior commitment in order for sustainable development to succeed. There are currently 1 billion people who lack access to energy, and 700 million don't have access to clean water, and thus achieving this access should be the priority in this discussion. Moving forward, our efforts should focus on finding solutions for sustainable development through means of implementation, innovative financing, and technology transfer. Saudi Arabia is a reliable resource for energy, and we stress the need for increased access to energy and water, as well finding a solution that are affordable, programmatic, and maintain national sovereignty and every national's right to development. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Ghazi. We in a few minutes, our hosts for the debate, I think the distinguished Minister Sultan Jaber of UAE, I don't know if the president of the GA, but they will want to make their closing remarks. So we actually have very, very few minutes left. And I will try the appeal one more time. If you could kindly please let the secretariat have your written statements, which can be exhibited in their full glory on the website. But if you could focus your remarks on the specific points that you want to get across, it would be highly appreciated to enable us to bring the session to a conclusion while interpretation is still with us. So we ask the distinguished representative of South Africa next, please. He is not in the room, so distinguished representative of Gabon.
Merci.
Thank you. I am going to focus on the essentials. The delegation of Gabon is aware of the close link between development and access to basic services and water and electricity. On this point, our highest authorities have taken a commitment to make water and electricity available to everyone at the least cost. And this is constantly being implemented through structural investment that is improving the services in Gabon. As far as the environment, Gabon is investing in clean energy by building hydroelectric dams for the production of electricity in order to put an end to thermal power plants, which have a high CO2 emission. Furthermore, we're currently at an experimental phase for new forms of energy, in particular solar energy, in certain regions of the country. And on this point, we are looking for partnerships in the area of capacity development in this area. Furthermore, we're favorable with regard to any contribution to implementing projects in these areas. And finally, we think, together with G77 in China, that to share good practices and experience would help us to bring together experiences on in the area of energy and water in order to contribute to the eradication of poverty. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank the distinguished representative of Gabon. And next we have the distinguished representative of France.
Merci, monsieur.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. France is a candidate to host the COP 2015, is, of course, very interested in this discussion. Even though, unfortunately, in this afternoon's discussion, we it's unfortunate that we've lost sight of the climate issue in favor of a discussion on the topic of the link between water and energy. And I would also like to echo Germany and other countries who have regretted that the issues of food security has not been taken into account in organizing this thematic debate, as was clearly stated by this roundtable. The use by the agricultural industry of water is a fundamental aspect that needs to be taken into consideration. So it would have been very useful for this topic to be also included in this discussion. I also had some comments to make with regard to the link would be useful to establish between the post-2015 sustainable development goals and climate change. This was somewhat touched upon in the previous roundtable, but less in this roundtable. But clearly, this is the debate that is essential. In other words, how our discussions will be transformed into concrete goals for the next 10 or 15 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Franz. Turn to the United Arab Emirates.
Thank you, moderator, at the last minute. I just have a question actually to ask, and perhaps I should address this question to Mr. Bruce Yayond, if he may give me an answer to it, and that is in regard to the future of water condensation particularly in hot climate countries where the majority of poor communities live, where they need badly drinking water, at least for those communities. I understand that Brazil has started some kind of water conservation projects for drinking water. I don't know how this can be generalized in most hot countries and whether there's any future to it really to help. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll, at the end, if there's time, there can be a response. Turn to New Zealand. And then after New Zealand, we have Morocco as the last speaker.
Thank you very much. Energy policy is at the forefront of our response to climate change. In New Zealand, we've got a high level of renewable energy already, but that comes mainly from water, hydro, electricity, and also geothermal. And we've heard today how climate change is altering the pattern of water availability, so we're very aware of the potential impact on our own ability to provide sustainable energy solutions in the low-carbon future. We place a high importance on the phasing out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. Getting incentives right to use energy efficiently will help ensure water security as demands on water will also be reduced. Just wanted to mention briefly that earlier this year, New Zealand had held the Pacific Energy Summit to advance renewable energy projects across the Pacific. This brought together a range of partners, private sector, states and multilateral banks and so on, and it raised a great deal of money. The challenge now is to translate this funding envelope into support for more than 40 renewable energy projects that the Pacific Islands had themselves identified. We hope that by next year, at the time of the SIDS conference in Samoa, it will be possible to show some tangible results already, because clean and efficient modern energy services are a cornerstone for sustainable development, economic activity and poverty eradication. I also just wanted to mention briefly the importance of the agriculture sector, which is vulnerable to climate change and also plays a vital role in food security. For New Zealand, it's also a major source of our greenhouse gas emissions. And a couple of years ago, we established the Global Research Alliance on Agricultural Greenhouse Gases and are working with about 32 other countries to develop ways to improve agricultural productivity and grow more food without increasing greenhouse gas emissions. We co-lead with the Netherlands, the work on livestock, and Uruguay leads on paddy rice, and Brazil on croplands. And, of course, more participants are welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, New Zealand. Our final speaker in this debate is Morocco. Thank you.
Merci, Monsieur.
Thank you very much, moderator. I'll be very brief. I would just like to share you with you a long-term vision as to how we can resolve this global sustainable puzzle. Building a global energy network, like an information network. So just like we have an information network, we could build an energy network. This would enable us to address the challenge of sustainable development. We're constantly being told that because of the financial crisis, economic crisis, that global partnership is difficult to make it work. And we're constantly being told that the reason for this economic crisis is that the global partnership has failed to work. So we could build a sustainable energy network in the same way as we have the information network at the global level. We have the Desertec project in North Africa. The aim of that project is to export solar energy to Europe. This is a long-term project. It's a project that's currently the subject of various assessments, and it's a way of achieving energy efficiency and saving on energy production costs. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those very useful remarks at the end. I'd like to thank the panel very much. Their participation and for actually responding to questions they were not aware they would be asked. And I'd like to thank you for your participation and brevity. And we'd like to invite His Excellency Dr. Sultana Jaber, Minister of State of the UAE, to the podium to deliver his final remarks before the closing of this session. Dr. Sultan.
President of the General Assembly, I would like to express my appreciation to all participants in the thematic debate for their invaluable insights and contribution to the deliberations on sustainable development and climate change, practical solutions, and the energy-water nexus. I now give the floor to Professor Jeffrey Sachs, the Director of the United Nations Sustainable Development Solutions Network and Director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all of you, and especially the hardy souls here who have spent a very long and thoughtful and very rich day discussing this topic. I won't summarize such a rich discussion. I wouldn't even dare to know how to begin, but I do want to highlight a few of the points that were made by the delegates. I very much agree and appreciated with the permanent representative of India, who said that we have the responsibility and the opportunity to build on the Rio Plus 20 principles. I think that gives a very sound basis for global action. And especially, I believe we can look forward to sustainable development goals adopted by this chamber, by the world's member states, that can inspire the world and help give direction to the world for the next 15-year period. I also agree with the representative of India that massive research and development is clearly needed. We saw today that there are many pathways, there are many options for humanity, but there is a lot of problem solving to do. There are technologies that require improvement. There are choices to be made and to be tested. There is the need for every region to find its own solutions, taking the portfolio of global options and applying them as makes most sense for the specific ecology, topography, resource base, culture, development challenges of individual countries. I very much appreciated what Mr. Joe Dadi said about the need for every country to explore a low-carbon energy approach, and think that it's very gratifying, as he said, that China is intensively examining how it can accelerate the peak of its own emissions. This is something that every country is going to have to do. And I want to say just in closing that this is a process that is a global effort that will last over the course of two generations to take us from our unsustainable trajectory today and dangerous trajectory